celebrated and never forgotten. This is likely the most difficult situation that I have faced in this seat. I sit in this chair because I care and I'm committed to this community.
Ultimately, the board voted 6-1 to fire Swigart. The termination is effective August 16th. Assistant Superintendent Corey Strasser will serve as the interim superintendent. For National Native News, I'm CJ Keene in Rapid City.
And on this day in 1975, 100 Native American protesters took over the Portland, Oregon offices of the Bonneville Power Administration. The occupation was part of several activities organized to protest what they said was federal repression on South Dakota's Pine Ridge and Rosebud Indian reservations. Similar occupations were staged at Alcatraz Island in 1969 and the BIA office in Washington, D.C. in 1972. This is National Native News. I'm Brian Bull, hosting from KLCC in Eugene, Oregon.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, August 15, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Eliza Yurkoff, Eric Tegudov, Suzanne Potter, and Roz Brown. The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Public News Service and Native Voice One. The director of evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I am Annette Newell. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members, and if you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News In Depth up next.
Welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest with Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. It's critical commentary on foreign affairs from a human interest perspective. The opinions expressed in the following segment are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest. I'm Mel Gertov. I'll be reporting and commenting on the most important and sometimes the most neglected international news of the week. First, in England, protesters crowd out the far right. Anti-immigrant right-wing groups in England had set cities and police forces on edge when they rioted at the start of August, breaking into asylum centers and law offices and damaging mosques. Police mobilized in several cities and had to call in reserves. But contrary to expectations of more violence, ordinary people came into the streets in several cities in counter-protests that drove most of the far-right groups away. In parts of London, for instance, The Guardian reports that, quote, thousands of local people and anti-fascist activists came together and held placards saying, "We are one human race," and "Unite against hate." In the end, The Guardian reports, counter-protesters outnumbered those supporting the far-right-led protests. It was a win for decency and human rights. A police spokesman said, quote, "The law-abiding public have no time for the mindless criminality we have seen, and last night proves that. We must thank our communities for standing united against wanton thuggery." With order restored, Britain and its new Labour government must now deal with two contending issues: the underlying causes of the rioting, which centered in the economically worst off parts of Britain, anger at immigration, few jobs, and declining health care and other public services, and the far right's hate speech aimed at arousing violence. Prime Minister Keir Starmer will have to do more than simply arrest people. He will have to deal with the way the far right used social media. A former Twitter executive has suggested threatening Elon Musk with an arrest warrant as one way to deter the far right's online lying. Nor can Starmer repeat his predecessor's disastrous plan on immigration by sending asylum seekers back to Rwanda. As one commentator put it, quote, "The animosities underpinning the riots, hatred of Muslims and migrants alike, have long found expression in Britain's political culture, not least under the previous Conservative government whose cornerstone commitment was to stop the boats on which migrants made their way to British shores," unquote. Next, the chips war with China is proving hard to win. Preventing China from acquiring the most advanced semiconductor chips and simultaneously building up U.S. chip capacity are huge undertakings. The former aim requires plugging holes in the global supply chain and gaining the cooperation of the major chip manufacturers. The latter aim requires a huge investment commitment by the chip makers, such as Intel, Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Company, TSMC, and Microsoft, in the hundreds of billions of dollars, subsidized by the U.S. government under the Chips and Science Act. Both aims have been difficult to achieve. The first, to attract chip making to the U.S., was thought to have been met when TSMC, Taiwan's premier semiconductor company, committed in 2020 to building a $65 billion plant outside Phoenix. The Biden administration gave the company a $6.6 billion subsidy under the Chips Act. TSMC has yet to produce any chips. The reasons are the same as those that have troubled Chinese investors from the People's Republic: cultural clashes between Taiwan and American workers over workplace practices. The Taiwanese simply work harder and longer than American workers, and training the most skilled engineers takes many months. If you've ever seen the movie American Factory, you know what this is about. Now the expectation is that TSMC will start producing chips early next year, though if Trump is elected, production could be complicated. He has assailed the subsidy deal with TSMC, arguing that Taiwan will ultimately keep control of chip making. As for the aim to keep chips out of Chinese hands, it has largely been defeated by globalization, that is, the worldwide supply chain, which has resulted in a lively chips market in China, despite U.S. national security bans on exports. Although NVIDIA's advanced AI chips have been kept from being exported to China, The Times reports that it spoke with representatives of 11 companies in China that said they sold or transported banned NVIDIA chips and found dozens more businesses offering them online. The Times also found procurement documents showing that more than a dozen Chinese state-affiliated entities purchased restricted chips, including organizations under sanction for modernizing the Chinese military, unquote. In a word, the global supply chain makes it all too easy to get around U.S. export controls, and the profit motive is outpacing national security considerations. U.S. bases in the Middle East, deterrence or targets? When the supreme leader of Iran says he's going to avenge, we have to take that seriously. We've got to make darn sure that we're ready and we have the capabilities in the region to be able to help Israel defend itself and, quite frankly, defend our own people and our own facilities. So said White House National Security Communications Advisor John Kirby. Obscured by that statement is the large number of U.S. bases and other military facilities spread across the Middle East, facilities that have been ripe targets for attack by Iran-backed militants and other groups. An investigation by Nick Tulsi for The Intercept finds that in all, the U.S. has 60 bases and other military access points. These sites, says Tulsi, range from small combat outposts to massive air bases in 13 countries, and they house altogether about 30,000 troops. The Pentagon will not acknowledge, much less divulge, most information about these deployments. As the U.S. moves more naval and air power into the Middle East to deter Iran and Hezbollah, its proxy, questions arise about their value, measured against the costs in U.S. lives and the security of friendly countries. Malta counts at least 145 U.S. dead since last October, the latest being the rocket attack on Al-Asad Air Base in Iraq, August 5th, that reportedly injured five U.S. military personnel and contractors. When the question is asked about whether or not the U.S. will be involved in a wider war in the region, the answer is that it already is, mainly a proxy war with Iran that is proving very costly. In other news, U.S. containment of China continues, and China continues protesting. Countries friendly to the U.S., or at least concerned about a threat from China, are boosting their security situations, mainly with U.S. encouragement and in some cases with substantial U.S. funds. One example is the U.S.-Philippines alliance. Secretary of State Blinken and Secretary of Defense Austin met with Philippines President Ferdinand Marcos Jr. recently to announce new military funding to boost the Philippines' external defense and help establish a military intelligence sharing pact between the two nations. As I have been reporting, confrontations are quite regular between heavily armed Chinese Coast Guard vessels and Philippine ships in a part of the South China Sea that does belong to the Philippines. Each side constantly accuses the other of reckless actions, though just recently they reached a provisional agreement that allows the Philippines to resupply an old ship in the disputed area. Another component of containment of China is Japan's closer strategic alignment with U.S.-China policy. During the U.S. and Japan's 2+2 security talks, these are talks led by each country's defense chief and top diplomat, both sides affirmed upgrading the command and control of U.S. forces in Japan, as well as strengthening American-licensed missile production. The commander of the roughly 50,000 U.S. troops stationed in Japan will now have greater command authority. Kamikawa Yoko, Japan's foreign minister, said, quote, "We are standing at an historic turning point as the rules-based, free, and open international order is shaken to the core. Now it is a critical phase when our decision today determines our future." Secretary Austin said China is, quote, "engaging in coercive behavior, trying to change the status quo in the East and South China Seas, around Taiwan, and throughout the region." As usual, nothing was said about the impact on Chinese strategic thinking of all these expanded military arrangements around China's periphery. Vietnam has also been active in response to adverse developments with China. A Vietnamese Coast Guard vessel visited the Philippines for a joint exercise. And Vietnam is doing what China has been doing, expanding island outposts in the South China Sea that it controls by adding land, clearly in response to tensions between China and Philippines. Finally, the U.S. Navy is reportedly investigating new sites in the Indian Ocean for base construction. The potential locations include Australia's Cocos Islands, Timor-Leste, and Papua New Guinea for anticipated construction projects under the so-called Pacific Deterrence Initiative, again with China in mind. Naturally, China has denounced these developments. A Chinese foreign minister spokesman said, quote, "They claim to promote regional peace and a rules-based international order, but are actually forming blocs, cobbling together exclusionary groupings, manipulating political games, and creating confrontations which are real threats to regional peace and stability," unquote. The spokesman specifically cited attempts to change the status quo in the South China Sea and U.S. efforts to bring together security coalitions aimed at China. What has happened to the five 9/11 detainees? CNN published the first photos of a War on Terror detainee in a CIA black site. The man is Ammar al-Baluchi, one of five at Guantanamo Bay, accused by the U.S. government of plotting the 9/11 attacks. The Pentagon announced that three of the five men, but not Baluchi, had agreed to plead guilty to all charges and would avoid possible death sentences. All of these men, along with about 100 others, had been subjected to torture at various black sites between 2002 and 2008 before being transferred to Guantanamo. No trials have occurred. Instead, the detainees have been tortured in ways that humiliate and sexually abuse them. The CIA probably has thousands of pictures that document the abuse, but of course they are highly classified. So CNN's photos were a first. China brings Palestinian factions together, maybe. China's Middle East diplomacy has had little impact, but it has succeeded at bringing together the two major Palestinian factions that have long been at odds. In a so-called Beijing declaration, Hamas and Fatah agreed to work together to create conditions for a single Palestinian state in the Gaza Strip, Jerusalem, and the West Bank. The idea is to form a unity government, hold elections, and eventually create a new state. Two obstacles stand in the way: Israel's opposition to both groups as governing authorities, and a history of discord between Fatah and Hamas, despite many proclamations of reconciliation in the past. In fact, in recent months, Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas accused Hamas of prolonging the Gaza war, and Hamas leaders in turn accused Abbas of siding with Israel. Finally, one illiberal democracy is overthrown, another democracy clamps down. Student-led protests in Bangladesh over several weeks have toppled the government of Sheikh Hasina. The daughter of Bangladesh's previous leader, Sheikh Mujibur Rahman, she had ruled since 2009, having been elected four times. Despite a number of achievements, including increased economic growth and personal income, and advances in women's rights, Prime Minister Hasina also became more authoritarian. According to a New York Times account, quote, "Over the past 15 years, Ms. Hasina deeply entrenched her authority and divided the nation. Those who kissed the ring were rewarded with patronage, power, and impunity. Dissenters were met with crackdowns, endless legal entanglement, and imprisonment," unquote. The patronage issue, giving a percentage of government jobs to loyalists, is what touched off the demonstrations. From Dhaka, Amnesty International reports, quote, "The peaceful protests were met with a severe crackdown from the police, military, and paramilitary units. Violence led to deaths of more than 300 people, with thousands more injured and more than 10,000 believed to have been arrested or arbitrarily detained. Amnesty International verified evidence of unlawful force being used against protesters. These attacks included the use of tear gas, rods, sticks, bricks, and firearms. Additionally, last month the internet was shut down for nearly a week and a curfew was installed with a shoot-on-site order from authorities. Student protesters rose up and called on people from across the country to march to the Capitol. On August 4th, the protesters defied the security forces and made their way to Hasina's official residence, taking it over and forcing her to flee. The military has announced plans to form a transitional government. Meantime, the country's president made an extraordinary interim appointment to head the country, Muhammad Yunus, a Nobel laureate known worldwide for implementing microfinance programs in Bangladesh to spur local-level development with small grants, mainly to women. Yunus will have a tough job, bringing the violence to an end, negotiating on new elections, and obtaining cooperation from the army and police. Next door in Thailand, democracy suffered in a different way. One of the country's most popular politicians was banned from politics for 10 years and his party ordered disbanded, all because he persisted in efforts to end lèse majesté laws that protect the monarchy from criticism. Thailand's constitutional court issued these orders against Pita Limjaronaut and his Move Forward party, which came in first in general elections and led Pita to bid to become prime minister. But as often happens in Thai politics, military-backed parties blocked him and installed the current prime minister, Sirleaf Thavisin. The court's decision has been roundly criticized by the U.S. and the European Union. A spokesman for the UN General Assembly said, "It's a setback to pluralism and democracy in Thailand and fundamental freedoms of association and expression." That's the Global Citizen International Digest for the week. I'm Mel Gertov. Thanks for listening and take good care.
Cable News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to Cable News in Depth. I'm Althea Billings. The No Harbor for Genocide campaign is targeting what it calls ships of death bound for Israel. The campaign has already succeeded in forcing the tanker Overseas Santorini to reroute. Adrienne Pine is a professor of anthropology at the California Institute of Integral Studies and the coordinator of the International Coalition to Stop Genocide in Palestine. She spoke with KBOO contributor David Rosenberg.
What is the No Harbor for Genocide plan all about, or what would you call it, a campaign?
Sure. The No Harbor for Genocide campaign really began in earnest a few weeks ago because a number of us from different organizations, the one that I represent, as well as the Disrupt Power, SOMO in the Netherlands, and various other sort of research groups have been following these two ships, the two tankers from the overseas group called the Overseas Santorini and the Overseas Suncoast, that for many years now have been the exclusive transporters of the J-8 jet fuel that Israel needs for its air fleet, to fuel its entire air fleet. That comes from a Valero refinery in Corpus Christi, Texas, and then it is shipped across the Atlantic through the Mediterranean to the port of Ashkelon in Israel. So what we realize is that since countries are refusing to enact the blockade that social movements are demanding and that is required of them under the Genocide Convention to not be complicit in genocide, that social movements really need to step up and create a people's blockade. And so what we did a few weeks ago was really to put out a call to action and to reach out to social movements in, first of all, the countries where the ships have historically docked, primarily Spain and Cyprus, but then also to create a plan throughout the Mediterranean to make sure that nations know, that governments know, that allowing the ship to dock will be breaching international law and also making them complicit in genocide and subject to legal prosecution at the ICC as well. And then also taking many actions, you know, actions at the port, mobilizing unions, speaking to port authorities to ensure that this ship, the Overseas Santorini, which just passed through the Strait of Gibraltar, will not find harbor in any Mediterranean country, will not be able to refuel. And ultimately, obviously, the goal is to prevent the jet fuel from reaching Israel, where it is exclusively being used in a genocide against Palestinians.
Is this similar to what's been going on the West Coast, where people are blocking Israeli ships at the port of Oakland and probably in other West Coast cities? Or if it is this a much bigger, broader effort?
We definitely applaud the efforts of people who have been trying to block the boats on the West Coast, and it's an inspiration. This effort is, I think, a more coordinated effort focused on a specific supply chain, but then aimed ultimately at building out a network that can prevent all tankers carrying weapons, ammunition, and oil to Israel, as opposed to just sort of direct action, or not a, as opposed to, but in addition to direct action, we're really going on many, many fronts, legal fronts, political fronts, and media, to make it impossible for the ships to go, not just, again, not just from direct action, but making it clear to politicians, to governments, to port authorities, that they will be held accountable for being complicit in genocide if they allow this ship to dock or to pass through their waters. And so it's aimed to be a coordinated effort that is much more like what we saw against apartheid South Africa, which of course had the coordination of dock workers, port workers around the world had a tremendous impact in the end of apartheid in South Africa.
What do these ships do? Do you know if they can't get to the ports of their destination? You know, the Houthis were attacking ships in the Red Sea, and then the U.S. and the U.K. were firing back to get those ships out. So I guess you would expect some sort of retaliation by the Israelis or their Western allies.
Well, we're not, we don't have the same tactics as Ansar Allah. Obviously, what they have achieved in the Red Sea, it certainly is the only example of a blockade. It's the only example of a state, Yemen, taking seriously its obligation under the Genocide Convention to prevent a genocide from happening. But we're not using those tactics. We're not bombing the ships. We're not, we're not shooting at them. We're using the tactics that are by and large legally available to us to effect this blockade. And so I think it would be difficult for Israel to retaliate militarily in most places in the Mediterranean in the way that it has in the Red Sea. I mean, I would never say never. It's Israel. We've seen how they've been acting completely outside of the law, including, you know, in Lebanon and Iran. But I think that certainly we are going to see a ramping up. We're, you know, obviously Israel is aware of this. It's been in the media all over Europe. And, you know, and likely NATO is going to get involved at a deeper level. It's important to know that these two ships are not only carrying fuel on behalf of the U.S. military and the U.S. government, but they are also basically deputized to act as ships for the Department of Defense. They oversee Santorini as part of what's called the Tanker Security Program of the U.S. military, which means that in an instance of emergency, the U.S. military can basically take over the ship and use it for whatever purposes it wants. So it's already clearly militarily aligned. Its sister ship, the Overseas Suncoast, which also carries jet fuel to Israel and does other runs as well, is currently stationed at a U.S. military base in Spain, at Rota. So their military connections and their NATO connections are very, very clear.
So it's totally impractical and maybe impossible to fly in the fuel?
Yeah, there's more fuel than could be flown in. So it would be impossible really to fly in this quantity of fuel. We're talking about 300,000 barrels of fuel, which for reference is capable of refueling an F-16 fighter jet, the kind that Israel uses, 12,000 times. So that's a lot of flights we're talking about. It's a lot of bombs dropped. It's a lot of Palestinian lives and families destroyed. So that is more than a plane could carry. And also it couldn't be transferred to a plane. You know, it would have to dock. It would be a tremendously complicated process. Of course, it is likely that the ship will reach Israel this time around, in part because it's a very large tanker. It should have enough fuel to be able to get there without docking. So it's possible that we won't be able to stop it this time around. But what we're hoping is that with this trip, countries will become so mobilized that it will ensure that this ship is a pariah and that it won't be able to refuel on the way back either. Generally, it stops at Limassol in Cyprus, for example. So what we are trying to ensure is that there is no port in the Mediterranean or, frankly, on the Gulf Coast, the Gulf of Mexico coast of the southern United States, where this ship will be able to dock in the future.
And so, if these ships did dock in ports other than in Israel, could the fuel then be transported by train or truck?
It's conceivable, but it would be very difficult, is my understanding. I can't tell you that I'm 100% certain of that answer, but I do not believe that it is transportable in that way, given how it is currently contained and the mechanisms needed for offloading it.
So potentially this campaign could have the effect of stopping the supply chain to Israel, right?
That's the goal. The goal of this campaign is to stop the supply chain that is making the genocide possible. We want to stop fueling the genocide, quite literally.
The coalition that you've built up, you mentioned some of the players there. Would you say it's totally international at this point, or is it more like
we've got a massive international coalition working on this campaign, and it's really thrilling, to be honest. We've got endorsers since we issued the call to action just a couple weeks ago. As I mentioned, we're working with Progressive International, La Via Campesina, the largest peasant organization in the world, has endorsed and is actively collaborating. And we have organizations in just about every Mediterranean country that are very engaged, that are very active, because this represents really one of the first options for concrete actions that we can take as people who aren't politicians, as social movements, to end this genocide that our politicians, that our states are refusing to take action against.
Logistically and practically, this is something that can succeed probably better than trying to break the Gaza blockade at this point, would you say?
Yeah, breaking the Gaza blockade, really, you know, it all depends on Israel. I mean, Israel is not backing down, and the states, you know, are not pressuring them. The United States is not, the Biden administration has no interest clearly in pressuring Israel. Every red line that he has supposedly placed has been crossed tenfold, and we're doing nothing. So obviously it's atrocious that Israel has used starvation as genocide, that it has bombed Gaza's main water supply. And we need to fight against that. But right now we have a chance to stop the actual vehicles of genocide, which are the planes that their army uses. So we can stop that form of killing, and we need to do it.
Do you know if the Israelis are almost out of jet fuel, or that's probably secret information?
Well, I know they're going through it very quickly, and they've been loading, the ship has been going to Israel and unloading this amount, this massive amount of jet fuel every 2 months since October 7th, and actually for years before that as well. And so we know they're going through that, and they do need to be replenished. So we aim to stop that so that their jets will be grounded.
And then they would still have ground troops to send into Gaza. Maybe they would stop the bombing, but they would not stop the killing, that kind of thing.
That's true. Although, of course, the vast majority of the deaths have been a result of the bombing campaign from Israel. So it would dramatically reduce their ability to indiscriminately murder, as part of this genocide, the indigenous Palestinian population. And they would have to rely exclusively on ground troops. And of course, that would be a huge win, because it would prevent so many more people from being murdered.
And this is a jet fuel. This doesn't apply to helicopter gunships.
It's J-8 jet fuel, and other types of military fuel have historically been transported from the Valero refinery in Corpus Christi, Texas, to Israel. So J-8 fuel is what most of the Israeli Air Force uses, as I understand, not my area of expertise, really, but I can say that without this, most of its fleet will not be able to function.
That was Adrian Pine of the International Coalition to Stop Genocide in Palestine speaking with KABU contributor David Rosenberg. This has been KABU News in Depth. I'm Althea Billings. Thanks for being with us.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KABU Community Radio.